Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, I am your host, Adam Lowther. And we have, yes, you know I'm going to say it, we have a great guest. Of course, I'm talking about Ben Souther, who is the president. He is the president of Bechtel National and the general manager of the environmental security business line at Bechtel's Nuclear Security and Environmental Global Business Unit. So it's a big title, Ben. So one of the things, well, first of all, welcome to NucleCast. It's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Adam. Appreciate being here, buddy.
Well, you know, the great thing is, you know, as we were talking before and as I saw that when you were going to come on and read your bio, and I was like, for me as a guy living in Riyadh, you were the guy that was responsible for building the metro here in Riyadh. So, of course, I thought, oh, man, this will be great. We have that, you know, that commonality to talk about. So for many of our listeners who may not know Riyadh or know Saudi Arabia, can you maybe just kick us off a little bit? I know this is not necessarily a nuclear topic, but tell us a little bit about building the Riyadh metro, because Riyadh is kind of a crazy place. And so building a metro here was kind of a first in class thing for Saudi Arabia and for Riyadh. And it's a, you know, it's a city that has grown. It's up to almost 10 million people now. And it wasn't 20 years ago that it was a couple million people. So it's and they're going to bring in 5 million more people in the next 5 years. So building the metro was like a big deal. So tell us a little bit about building the metro. I'm just curious about the engineering of it and just how you overcame all the challenges that you can have in building these kind of projects, you know, overseas.
Yeah, sure. Happy to do it. And thanks for having me, Adam. Pretty excited when I heard that you were in Riyadh today as well. I spent 7 years there, and I got to tell you, it took a pretty outstanding team to build it. As you could imagine, between the design side, we had design engineers from Bechtel to other ones across the globe working on things. We had peaked out around 30,000 people working on that job. We had tremendous partners that were part of a joint venture. Siemens provided the rolling stock and transit systems, and so it takes quite a few to build a project like that. Bechtel's scope was lines 1 and 2, which runs north and south, and then line 2 is east and west, or the red and blue lines. 38 stations, 3 depots. We had all the road works to be done and supporting utilities along that, park and ride facilities, and just, I'd call it a once in a career opportunity to build something like that, because most cities won't take on a project that large all in one phase. And you got to hand it to Vision 2030 and MBS and what they did with setting out a plan to get 6 metro lines built in the city of Riyadh to be able to help with some of the really difficult traffic congestion that exists in that city. And I would say it wasn't easy. You've experienced some of the traffic, so all the traffic diversions to put in place. But the fact that it's up and running now and 100 million passengers in August was just a tremendous achievement, and looking forward to see the extensions and the additional lines that they'll put in.
Yeah, it's and you know, it's funny because talking about this and the kind of challenge that this project was leads into some of the work that Bechtel does for the Department of Energy and NNSA. Can you maybe sort of segue over into those? And I know you specifically focus on a lot of environmental issues and those sort of challenges. So maybe also give us a little bit about how you deal with those kind of issues.
Sure. Maybe I'll just kind of segue with giving you a bit of a background on me, and then that might help with explaining kind of what we'll get into with DOE. I've been with Bechtel for about 23 years, worked on the government side, but also in other parts of our business on public infrastructure, and have worked obviously in the Middle East, but have also worked in the Pacific. There's an island out there in the middle of the Pacific on the Marshall Islands, which is Kwajalein, which is part of a Department of Defense program and as part of the missile systems. And people probably remember the Ronald Reagan Star Wars programs and the deep space tracking that goes on there. And then I've worked in cleanup for DOD for the Chem-to-Mil programs and a few others. So that's a bit about, you know, career-wise. One of the things, the business line that I have today is our work with Department of Energy, mainly with National Nuclear Security Administration and then also with Environmental Management, which are the two main groups that we serve. We have projects for EM, which is WTP in Hanford, Washington, which is the cleanup, pretty big milestone that was just celebrated with vitrifying radiological waste now, which is a tremendous achievement. We'll talk about how to bring projects over the finish line maybe a little bit later, but how the team pulled together to do that was just pretty outstanding to see. There's nothing like it when that happens. Then we have WIP, which is the waste isolation pilot plant that's in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Interestingly, Bechtel had designed that facility in the 80s and built it, and I came across some cool historic photos of the Bechtel PM out there in the groundbreaking ceremony, which was pretty cool, and to now be at the point where we're managing and operating it and conducting their capital projects is pretty tremendous opportunity, and it's really kind of an honor for us to do something like that. But then we have other sites on the NNSA side as part of the nuclear security enterprise, which is Y-12 National Security Site. We also have Lawrence Livermore National Lab. And then we do work with Naval Reactors Program. So for us, it's a, I'll say it again, it's an honor to support the Department of Energy. We started working with them back in 1948 when it was Atomic Energy Commission, and we have a long history of supporting DOE and the nuclear programs. We don't take that responsibility lightly. There's a lot we've learned over the years. And we also feel that we've got a lot to give back. And so maybe this is a good way to segue, Adam, for your question that prompted all this, which is, you know, how do you take something like that on the infrastructure side in Riyadh Metro, which is very different than, you know, nuclear deterrent program? And I think that's one of the uniquenesses that Bechtel brings is we try and bring a blend of talent, right? And if you look at, you know, what goes into these management and operations contracts is the value the industry brings is that we bring the commercial practices, right, or the practices from other parts of the business and blend that with what we're doing in the government. And that's really the main value that happens with industry and the government contracting with companies like Bechtel, where we can bring those best practices that you're required to do to actually survive in those businesses and infuse them with the government. And so that's what we're doing at those sites today. And one of the values I think that Bechtel brings is we bring people that actually have the practical experience in delivery roles that have been, you know, on the direct hire construction, where they're, you know, our craft that are doing the work and our engineers. And then we do the same thing, which is different from some of the other consulting type models that are out there, where we have all the resources in-house to be able to do that. And then we also pride ourselves on the relationships that we've built with the supply chain along the way to be able to execute this work.
Yeah, and I can imagine just when you build a project like the Riyadh Metro, that there's so many lessons you learn and so many challenges that you face that as you then shift to, you know, building new buildings at Y-12 or wherever you may be building new stuff, you can incorporate those lessons you would have never gotten otherwise. And you incorporate them into, you know, how you're going to do stuff. And you say, hey, you know, here's, this was a challenge we had on this other project, and here's how we overcame it. And, you know, like manpower issues or skilled labor issues, or, you know, I'm sure those things arose in a non-nuclear project and you had to overcome them. And now you take those lessons and you apply them elsewhere.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. You know, interestingly, it's not, each project has its own set of unique circumstances and details, but a lot of it really comes down to the basics that you just mentioned about having qualified, skilled labor to get the work done is kind of a fundamental. But the other one is there's some basic human behaviors about how do we organize the work and get things done collectively. You know, on a small scale, you can kind of see how it happens if you've ever done any kind of home improvement projects with your buddies, right? And what's the plan and how you're going to go do it? And if there's three or four of you, you have a different way as to how you want to do it. We'll multiply that, you know, by tens of thousands, right? And having the work organized and structured in such a way that's aligned with what the customer wants to do, right, as well as how we think is the best way to execute that, takes quite a bit of effort to do. And there's a lot of lessons around how to structure and organize the work such that you get that sweet spot between how the customer wants to deliver, what's the optimum way for us to do it, and how does it align with the skill sets and other phases of the work. And so it ends up being a challenge, whether it's 30,000 people or it's 10,000 people like at a Y-12 or a few thousand people building the uranium processing facility. But those same kind of fundamentals tend to transfer over.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about was, NNSA is, they have this new enterprise blueprint, and it's got, all this long-term modernization that they really want to get at. They got all kinds of infrastructure projects. I mean, we've talked about this endlessly on NucleCast about buildings that are still around from the 1940s. And so there's all of this national security infrastructure that has to be replaced. And you guys have a big part in that. And you just mentioned a little bit of it, but can you tell me, maybe some more of what you're doing? And then I wonder, as I think back to just how quickly we were, let's take Y-12, for example, and Oak Ridge, how quickly we were able to build a huge, facility. And just, I think somebody, the historian at Oak Ridge said that it's like the size of the state of Rhode Island. And, to put up the fencing, for example, just one huge thing to fence off the state of Rhode Island. Yeah. And to do all of these things, and then now we have all the regulations and all the environmental requirements, and it's just so much more challenging to do things today. So yeah. Can you tell us what you're doing, and then particularly for you as somebody who has the responsibility for environmental, maybe kind of go into some of the challenges, what you're overcoming, do they slow you down? I mean, or are they well worth it? Or are there things, do we need exemptions for some things?
Yeah. Maybe I'd start with, I have to commend NNSA for putting together the blueprint that they did at the end of last year. To have, to sit down and come up with what are the capabilities required over the next 25 years to support the nuclear deterrent program would not be an easy task to sit down and do. I mean, you could imagine Adam sitting down to try and write that, especially considering, my words, but, I would say over the last, since like 92 and the end of the Cold War, things are really a bit more in a caretaker type status, maintain a constant state of readiness with the deterrent program, but really try and minimize the investment that we have to do in supporting infrastructure. And I can, get that, right? As taxpayers, we can understand that and minimizing those expenses. But, unfortunately, the things have changed, and over the last 5-6 years, that threat level has also changed, and it requires, unfortunately, us to make some changes in the deterrent program and to be direct an investment in the supporting infrastructure to make that happen. So I tremendous effort to make that happen and to lay out what's the plan to do it. The hard part now is how do you figure out how to fund all those types of efforts and do it in an environment, as you just pointed out, that how we did it previously in the 40s and 50s and 60s, if we do it that same way again, we're going to still have this major legacy of cleanup. I mean, we're still dealing with cleanup from the last go around. We were just talking about WTP and Hanford and all the plutonium that was processed up there and enriched, right? So that's, we want to do it in a smart way so that we don't, or I should say an environmentally safe way, but balanced with also how do we do it so that we can meet the demand that we have. So there is a difference between what was done during the Manhattan Project and versus what we need to do today. It's kind of a first point. Second one is, and it's good that there's bipartisan support for what we're trying to do with the deterrent program. And we're seeing some favorable signs in terms of projects coming online. There are things like the uranium processing facility that you know we talked about, but there's a number of other smaller projects at the labs, plants, and sites across the nuclear security enterprise that you can see that the organization is learning. Just like, you know, anywhere else where if you haven't done something for a while, the first time you do it takes a bit of time, right? And I think that the industry, I think we're all kind of learning from that. I think we're starting to get into a bit more of a battle rhythm, if you will, with building these projects. But I'd also put something into perspective. A lot of these facilities are one-off facilities, right? We're not going to go build 10 uranium processing facilities, right? So it's not like, you know, where you are today and just outside where you're staying, you built 38 stations. Well, 10 of them might all be the same, and you kind of figure out an economy of scale and kind of crank through them. And so they're naturally have some challenges with how do you do these unique type facilities. But I think that we're kind of getting there for what we need to do on it. Uranium processing facility, they've achieved what DOE calls CD4, which is construction completion on 5 of 7 sub-projects for uranium processing facility. What you'll hear from NNSA is for the last 25 months now, we've been on or ahead of the baseline schedule, which is pretty tremendous achievement by the team. And I think that we're also finding the right groove and battle rhythm between all the various teams that are required to make this happen. I think the collaboration that I'm seeing between our DOE counterparts at the field level as well as at headquarters is the best that I've seen. You know, I came back into this business after being gone for about 7 years, but to see how the teams are working together is really encouraging. I think there's still more that we need to do to figure out how to deliver capabilities faster and more efficient. Really encouraged by the current environment where there's a challenging of the status quo. And, you know, does it make sense for us to do some of the things that we've been doing? I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the rules and regulations have come up during a period where it wasn't a growth period, right? And that's where I think industry has a responsibility to bring some of those best practices from outside of the government world and how we can do things and then streamline things a bit more with how we deliver so that we're actually addressing the national security part, which is how do we deliver new capabilities faster and more efficient?
Yeah, that's a good point. And it kind of leads to a follow-on question that is about innovation. And I, you know, for years when we would go to, you know, the deterrence summit, and DOE leaders and NSA leaders would talk about projects, and they would often say, well, you know, we're working hard, but we're behind for, you know, COVID or because, you know, supply chain issues or whatever. And I wonder, are there specific, you know, innovations, let's say, that you've drawn from, because Bechtel does a lot of projects in a lot of different areas. And you kind of mentioned this earlier about pulling these lessons learned from other things, from other projects. Are there innovations that you're sort of incorporating into what you're doing that, you know, are making these, for example, enabling you to be on time for 24 of the last 25 months at, you know, UPF? Or, you know, is there a lot of innovation? And maybe tell us a little bit about it if there is some.
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of them. One, just touching on the lesson side. Best way to do a incorporation of lessons learned is the people that have experienced it, right? I think every company that's out there has probably got some sort of lessons learned program, and you can pull a binder out or you can look it up, and you can even get really intelligent with using AI and lessons learned. But at the end of the day, the most important part is to have the practitioners that lived the lesson before come in and apply it there on site. So that's probably the first point on that. As far as innovation goes, there's a couple things I'd highlight on the tech side, and then I would highlight a couple other things that are not on the tech side. On the tech side, you know, one of the things that has kind of typically happens is every year you get more and more requirements or more and more information that gets packed on, right? So as you know, sifting through the all of that barrage of information is really difficult to do, right? I mean, we experience in our own life just with the amount of things that kind of pop up. But imagine on these large complex projects, the amount of data that we capture. And so getting smart about how we align requirements that are come from not only from the government for what we're doing, but also building code requirements, our own procedures in terms of how we execute things, and then demonstrating from, you know, the inspection reports when we build and install things versus how we've designed it versus, you know, how the test records, you get this mountain of data, right? And it becomes, you know, a paper project is what we end up calling it. And so how you navigate through that has become an area where we've spent quite a bit of time that says at the end of a job, how do you prove that what we've built aligns with all those requirements, right? And it used to take a lot of manual effort, believe it or not, even though all the records were automated, you can kind of do some basic searches. It still took a tremendous amount of effort to deal with that. And so several years ago, we started doing more with machine learning at UPF on how to align those requirements with the test records so that we can prove that objectively, here's what we built, here's what we've tested, and this is how we know it's in alignment. And so they've made pretty significant advances on that, and so really proud of the work that they've done there. There's other things that are kind of on the cooler tech side, you know, like around the LiDAR scanning. So things like once you've built things, you need to know like kind of what's in there and as-builts and stuff like that. LiDAR scanning's become very helpful for us to deal with clashes. So sometimes you have to go back in and drill holes in concrete walls, which we don't really like doing, but you need to make sure that you don't hit the rebar and stuff like that. And we can address that through some of the LiDAR scanning. So there's, we're kind of always looking at the tech side of those types of things to help. We also bring it from other parts of our business, you know, to stay competitive in the energy business or even in the manufacturing and technology business. We have to be looking for ways to be more efficient in that. So some things that we'll end up doing is use of robotics around some of the surveying that we do. So we can feed the models into those robotics and they can mark the different survey points on our concrete slabs. That goes a long way. And so we try and keep a balance of what's available in the industry. And we have, you know, a Bechtel Construction and Bechtel Equipment Operations that looks at those things and test it out, right? And then we'll look to how we can go and deploy it. So that combination of what we're describing between our work with the US government and then work that we do outside, once we've proven those things, we'll pull them into the government to be able to help how we deliver on things. So that's kind of like the tech and the lesson side. But the other piece I'd say that you can probably get a lot more gain out of is having clarity of how we're going to finish the projects, or actually execute the projects, and structuring the program in such a way that there's incremental milestones that serve as proof points for the team that starts to believe in that vision on executing, right? And so when you start in front of a, you know, $10 billion job and you look at the millions of hours that are associated with it, it becomes a pretty daunting task, right, to figure that out. And so part of that becomes, like, how do you express that vision as to how you're going to finish? And that is, like, probably one of the hardest things to go from where you are today to that end point. And then once you kind of got it, explaining it and then breaking it down to those smaller chunks, and then each group has incremental milestones that they start to realize we're getting it done and we're getting closer. Because otherwise you feel like you're a bit lost in the desert with, where am I? Am I, like, getting there? And you have all these different charts, but you can't quite see it. So I just stress the importance of having a solid plan and executing against that plan and having the team believe in it. Because when you got several thousand people on a job and you're spending millions of dollars a day, having clarity on that is really important.
Join the ANWA Deterrence Center and NucleCast at the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, January 26th through 28th at the Crystal Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. This premier event brings together decision makers from government, national laboratories, and industry for strategic updates, high-value networking, and practical conversations that drive partnerships and business. Sign up through the link on our website to receive a 15% discount at anwadeter.org. We hope to see you there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm maybe just reasoning by analogy, you know, the famous Prussian strategist, Karl von Clausewitz. You know, it's my favorite German word. He said that the commander has to have Fingerspitzengefühl. So if you say that three times fast, Fingerspitzengefühl, and he means like fingertip feel, that you just have to have a sense of, he's talking about where to apply troops in the heat of battle, and that the good commander just knows what to do because he's done it, he's seen it, he has an innate sense of how to handle it. And so, you know, with these projects, I guess my question is, are you in, you know, sort of the Bechtel clan, or are you guys at that point where you have Fingerspitzengefühl with these projects, and you've done it enough that you just kind of know, hey, here's how we have to handle these issues?
Yeah, we probably, like most companies, go up and down that continuum with how much of a feel do you have, right? But what you just described is, in the essence of what's required to execute these projects, is you have to have that feel. And there is no substitute for being on the ground where it's happening, but also empowering the teams to make the decisions so that, you know, we don't have any kind of choke points on this kind of stuff. But you absolutely nailed it, Adam, where having that presence, having, let's call it control over the work, if you will, is extremely important to do. But then it's for a couple of reasons. One, because we can quickly make adjustments and decisions in the field as we go. But then also, if you put yourself in the customer shoes where they entrust us with a lot of responsibility, where people put their careers in our hands to deliver, and we also take that very seriously, and you want to have a contractor that knows that, right? You want to have a contractor that you can pick up the phone and get an answer on something, right? Back on the Riyadh Metro, what saved it, you know, we'd have pictures right there. We'd meet with the customer of, here's what we saw today on site on the job, and they understand that. To give it maybe a bit of a simplistic example, if you have a contractor that's ever done work at your house, the contractor that's there and on site and is working the issues with you is, like, you know, top notch. That's golden, right? And that's what we look for. And that, we expect that of our entire team, and that's how we execute our work.
So it's that time in the show where we bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants all guests three wishes, but they got to be about the topics we've discussed. So with that in mind, Ben, what is your first wish?
Oh, that's interesting. My first response was going to be, I don't do wishes. First wish would be that we continue the collaboration that's going on today, that's more narrowly focused on how we're going to deliver on the nuclear deterrent programs and the enhancements that are required. That focus and drive on delivery is what's required. In the past, we were really focused more on how are we going to, like, reduce the operational costs and things like that, but we weren't as focused on, you know, what's the right way for us to get these capabilities brought up and running. So that single-minded focus and purpose needs to continue for us to be able to get things where it needs to be for the deterrent program.
Yeah, that's a good start. Okay, now you get two more. So what's number two?
The second one is, when you look more broadly beyond just what's going on, you know, in the nuclear deterrent side of things, you look at what's happening with nuclear power, you look at what's happening, you know, public infrastructure, you look at what's going on in the construction industry as a whole, and it is a massive amount of work that is being undertaken globally. So the second wish I would say is around having and developing talent to be able to go and execute this work. And it starts, I think, from the schools and showing and demonstrating how, like, amazingly rewarding this work is and this line of business. I think there's some pockets we're doing really well. I mean, in my daughter's school, they've got this pretty amazing construction program where she's out there framing up houses and stuff like that in high school, which is great. And I think it's a wonderful start. And but we need to be able to continue that, where we need craft professionals to perform this work. And I stress the second part of that word, the craft professionals. It is not easy what they do. And so you know, investing the time and effort into the training programs and working with the unions to make that happen, I think is extremely important. So the second wish evolves around making sure we've got all the right talent from staff to craft professionals to execute the work that's ahead of us.
Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, final wish.
Oh, final wish. Well, you got to have fun doing all this stuff. So I hope that people still stay pretty excited and fired up about it. And it's really hard work, not to keep coming back to Riyadh, but in the thick of it, and you're in those points where you're just like, you know, you're tired and you're wore out and everything else. It's like the hardest things you've ever done. But when you look back on it, it was the coolest thing you ever did, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I think that, we need to just keep a clear perspective as we execute this large volume of work that it's like a once in a career opportunity, right, to do some of this stuff. And let's not lose sight of where we are. This is like freaking amazing, you know, work that we're doing. And let's get after it and get it done. So those are probably my three wishes.
Yeah, I like your, all three are good. The last one is, you know, that's kind of an important thing, because how many people get to do something in life where, you know, later on with their kids or grandkids, they can point to, you know, a building and say, hey, I built that building. Or they can say, hey, this metro we're on, I'm the guy that built the metro. So, you know, that is kind of a cool thing. You know, it's meaningful.
Maybe just add one last thing. I think the relationships, the teamwork, the collaboration is absolutely imperative for doing this. And where we get it right and we have a common vision, that is like also project gold. And that's how we get things done. And so I think that having that clarity of purpose in what we're doing becomes really important. And I would just stress that as all those involved in whatever aspect of the engineering, construction, supply chain, management and operations, having that, you know, seeking out understanding and having clarity of what we're trying to do is really important. And that collaboration will be absolutely key for what we're trying to do going forward.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. So, Ben, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thanks for having me, Adam. Appreciate the time.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.